Hello. My name is Kara, and I'm from the Sequential Artists Workshop with a lot of my teachers and peers. I wish I was so cool as to be in a band, but I'm not. I never was. But I am a high school art teacher, normally, when I'm not studying comics. And my story is about my very, very first year teaching in Lexington, Massachusetts, to a very kind of wealthy, upper-class town. And I hadn't been around teenagers since I'd been a teenager, and I was very unfamiliar, again, with like how they act and what was going to happen. And one of my coworkers invited me to go to Italy with a group of students, and the plane and the hotel fees would be taken care of. And I'd never been to Europe, and I was like, oh, that sounds amazing. Like, I'd love to go to Italy, yes. And so I went on the trip, and there were some factors that I hadn't thought through that kind of were negative for enjoying myself in Europe. And the first was that my coworker, who I didn't know well, was a little wacky and emotional. And you don't know those things until you're like across the ocean and trapped. You know, you're like, okay. Some of her decision making was not my decision making. So that was one factor. And the second is that what I didn't remember about being a teenager, and I never was a wealthy teenager, like these kids, was that when you go to Europe, which they've done before, it was nothing that new to them. They're not so interested in the art and the culture and the amazing stuff that I wanted to get excited about. They're really interested in the drinking age being, like, they can order a drink now that they're in Europe. And so that was their main goal, being there, is like, I can order drinks. And what happened was they were staying with host families. So at nighttime, like, it wasn't like I could check on them or whatever. And so, like, they would show up to the school, and we would meet them there, and you could tell there was, like, a group of boys, like, they were, they were so hungover. And I was like, oh, no, and I'd be like, you can't do that. But I also hadn't taught, and I didn't know how much I could control them. It was, like, the first time I'd really was trying to be a teacher, wasn't really a teacher yet. And then on the other side, my coworker would just, like, explode and cry and just be way over the top, and I was like, ugh. So I think that, like, the host families felt like, well, boys are boys and let them do what they want. Americans, it's okay. So they had this time living with these host families, kind of like freedom to go clubbing, whatever they were doing. We couldn't control it. And there was one strictly religious Mormon student there who was very upset with the boys and their activities. And I was like, oh, man, she's going to get me fired. Like, I don't know how to. So I would, you know, firmly speak to them. But later I found out that other teachers had taken kids on trips and had tried to, not press charges, but tried to get the kids in trouble when they got back to the States. And they had been fired for accusing the kids of, so it was a tricky situation. And at the very close of the trip, we brought them to Venice. And it was just like one of the most beautiful places you've ever seen. It looks, I don't know, I can't describe it, just so gorgeous. And they were so miserable because up until then they had all this freedom with the host families, and now they were trapped in a hotel with us, and, like, we were teachers and we had rules. And then my crazy coworker really losing it on them. And so they were the most unhappy Americans in Venice, like, ever. Most of them were sick by that point from probably making out with Italians, and, you know, and I was like, ugh. And so we got, you know, somehow got them home. They're, you know, a wreck. And and what I learned from that trip, now being an experienced teacher, is I only do trips that are service-based, or, like, when there is, like, a project to work on, or the kids are very focused. I don't just take them on a vacation. Like, that's not fun for me as an adult. And the other thing I learned, and this is just a funny side note, my cousin younger cousin came up to me at a holiday party and was like, hey, do you know this kid, blankety blank? And I was like, yeah, he went on the Italian trip with me. He was like a monster. You couldn't control him. And it was terrible. And he was like, yeah, he went to my college and came in with this big attitude, and he got punched in the face twice. And I was like, whoa, no way. And he was like, yeah, well, the first time, he was on the lacrosse team with me, and he was talking like he owned the place, and someone punched him. I'm like, well, that makes sense. And he said the second time he was on the New York subway, was like not aware of himself, and again, by a complete stranger, punched in the face. And I was like, whoa, okay. So I guess I also learned that the town that I teach, and I love these kids. I don't want to act like I don't love teaching. I don't love my students, but it was my very first year, and I didn't know anything. But I learned that this, sometimes a lot of them are in this like protective wealth bubble, and then once they break out and get into the real world, it punches them in the face. So that's my story.
Thanks so much. And thanks to Saw for coming out almost every month and telling lots of great stories. I always appreciate it. All right, come on up. That didn't take too long. Thanks. Thanks. Thank you. Introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Andrew. So about 5 years ago, I was visiting my friend in Athens, and this friend would actually eventually introduce me to my girlfriend, Alice. And we decided to go to an island outside of Greece, about four or five of us. And it was sort of remote, which obviously like was the point. It was very beautiful, but there really wasn't any place to stay except for a campground. And so we had this great day. We like rode around the island, ate fresh octopus, and we settled down for the night, which was terrible for all of us for three reasons. The first was that next to our tent was an old man who mumbled to himself just audibly the entire night for all of us to not sleep at all. And that was actually the easiest part of the three. The second was that the campground had an incredible mosquito problem, and my friend Rosie, who I was visiting, was incredibly adept at killing the mosquitoes such that when we woke up, the white linen was lined with probably over 20 red splotches from her just karate chopping them in the night. And the third is that one of our companions refused to heed the warnings to not eat the ice or drink something with ice in it on this island because it was not for foreigners to eat or drink, or our stomachs just couldn't handle it. And she had a serious problem in the middle of the night with, you understand what's happening here. And the campsite didn't have any toilet paper, so I understand we're all eating, but just put yourself in her shoes. So when we woke up the following morning with such a terrible time, and the campground keepers told us they would actually be charging us more than they told us they would, which was incredibly cheap. I think they told us it was €5 per person per night, and they wanted to charge us 7 or something like that, or maybe it was even 3 to 5. We just refused to pay that amount because of the terrible night we had. And so in return for us refusing to pay for it, they refused to give us our passports back. And we discussed it. We're like, are we actually going to go through with this, or we should just pay the extra €2? And then Victoria, who is the girl who ate the ice, you know, the look on her face just made us continue with it. And so eventually we had like the local police, if you can even call them that, come down to the campgrounds and have this big standoff with the campground owners in Greek, which we obviously couldn't even understand. And eventually it was like 3 hours before the boat was going back to the Man Islands, and we were ready just to quit and to pay the extra €2, but the people finally reluctantly agreed to accept the €5 per person per night, so we got our way. Stand your ground.
Thanks. So on tour, who's next? Sally.
I just basically chugged a beer on an empty stomach, so that's why I'm brave enough to come up here and tell my story. I spent the I spent the whole day like, am I going to tell this story because it's going to get recorded? Do I want my mom to know what happened? No. So this is also another band story, but not a, like an in a band story. We were decided because we had a couple week, like a weekend and a couple days off to during the summer. So we were like, oh, let's just follow our friend's band on tour for a while. Like, let's just go to a bunch of their shows. And we started in, this was when I lived up in the Northeast. So we started in Philly. And after the show in Philly, where I had been drinking, we went to a bar where there was kind of an informal after party for everybody where I kept drinking. And I was there with my friend Mel, and right from Philly, we were going to drive to Baltimore. Our logic was, well, we'll drive to Baltimore, we'll get there, then we can crash out and just sleep till like 4 o'clock tomorrow, and it won't be a big deal. So halfway between, it was like 2 a.m. when we left, it was like bar time when we left, and halfway between Philly and getting to Baltimore, so probably somewhere in Delaware, I was like, Mel, I really gotta pee, you gotta let me out of the car, I gotta pee. So she pulls over at like the brightest, just fluorescent bright lights in this welcome center. It was like the Delaware Welcome Center or something. It was like a bug zapper. It was so bright. And stumbled in, whatever, came back out, and totally uneventful drive back, like all the way down to Baltimore. We get to Baltimore and we find out that the hotel that we were supposed to stay at, which was a really terrible hotel that we had just picked because they didn't have like a limit of when you can check in. So we could check in. We thought we could check in at 4 a.m. They were like, well, we don't know if we're going to let you do that. So Mel is inside dealing with the hotel because she's sober and trying to convince them not to charge her again and just let us have the hotel room because I don't think there's anybody else at the hotel. I was in the car freaking out because our tickets to the show in Baltimore had disappeared. And, you know, in between me being drunk and Mel running in and out of the hotel, we were like both hysterical crying like, oh my God, we've lost the tickets. We're getting charged again for the hotel. Oh my God, we have no money. We're freaking out. We're in Baltimore. I was convinced that like when I had gotten out of the car at the welcome center in Delaware, I had like dropped the tickets out of the car or something. And eventually like I'm panicking. I'm like just coming off of being super drunk and like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, this is horrible. And I get out of the car and I was sitting on the tickets the whole time. And I was like, I didn't think to get out of the seat to look around the car. I was like, I'm just going to stay in the car and look. Like, I couldn't possibly be sitting on them, right? So I had been sitting on the tickets the whole time. And eventually, like, the hotel situation was fine and we had a good time. But it was just, Mel just like wouldn't talk to me for the next 12 hours because she was just like, you were sitting on the tickets. But anyway, all right, thanks.
Thanks. So any more on tour? Any kind of tour? All right.
Hello, everyone. I am Joseph. I am also from Saul. All right. I took a tour one time to New York City with my family, as all upper middle class white families do. I was in sixth grade, and this was a critical time in my life. When I wanted to, desperately to look cool and hip, right? But I can't be 10 feet away from my parents. My mother decides that we have to stay in a hotel in Times Square because it's the New York experience, right? What she didn't realize until we got there was that only tourists go to Times Square, and that waiting for an elevator will take 30 minutes. Anyway, so we're walking around town. We pass a, what's called an S&M club, right? My older sister asked my parents, why are these people walking in and out of this club in these ridiculous outfits? Now, I, having, being self-educated on the subject, I am able to answer this question, but I decide that it's better to leave it a mystery to her for the time being. So we continue on our way to the Staten Island Ferry. The ferry. Doesn't that sound like fun? We're on a boat. Among the waves. It's a beautiful spring day. It's also very cold. I'm starting to regret that I didn't bring my jacket, but at least people can see my Led Zeppelin shirt. Anyway, finally we pass Staten Island. We see Lady Liberty. We try to enjoy it, but we're too distracted by the wind whipping through our hair and ears and eyes. And eventually we pull back into Manhattan. We're stepping off the ramp. My parents start talking to some sort of a couple, I guess. They're really hitting it off for some reason. They decide Chinese would be a great way to get to know each other. So we head to the nearest little Shanghai or whatever. And I'm eating some chicken. I'm not really enjoying it. Neither is my sister. I make her situation worse by sticking the chicken in her face. Eventually, the couple gets up to use the restroom, and they never return. And my family gets a little upset. But they pay the bill because you have to do that. And we walk outside, and everyone's kind of bummed out. There's just a general vacation weariness settling over us. So my dad decides that we should walk it out. We are about 40 blocks north of our hotel, and my dad thinks that we should just eschew the subway and see New York, right? Just walk on the sidewalk, check out all the buildings. So we do. And it's okay, it turns out, for the first 5 blocks. But we were only 1/8 of the way there. And the afternoon sets on, and our feet get sore and sore. Finally, we arrive back at the hotel. We wait 30 minutes for our elevator. We're zooming up the shaft, and I'm looking outside because it's a glass elevator, and I say, at least the hotel is cool.
Thank goodness.
Okay, I've got... okay, thanks. Save that for afterwards. I've got a couple short stories about on tour. I'm going to start off with Saturday night when I went to see Cheap Trick alone. So I got in my car alone, and I drove to the concert alone, and I sat down alone. And you can see where this is kind of going, maybe. And I'm watching the band, and I'm really rather enjoying myself, actually. They come on stage, and the weird thing is I wasn't really a big fan. I remember this stuff from when my older sister was younger, if you believe that. Anyway, so I just went just because I had nothing else to do, and I always liked a few of these songs. But they come on stage, and I start to cry. And I can't quite figure out why I'm crying for this band that I didn't even own an album for until the Friends of the Library saw it sale last year. But then they kept playing, and I realized, oh my God, I think I'm suddenly a Cheap Trick fan, you know? I don't know where it came from, but now I have to buy all the albums, you know? And every song that I didn't know, I thought was even better than the ones I did know, until they did I Want You to Want Me, and Robin Zander is like superhumanly hot. I think you all know what he looks like, right? And I had a thing for the bass player as well. And I was out in the audience, and they had this thing where they chuck guitar picks out into the audience, and not like one or two, but like handfuls and gobs of them. And people are like clamoring to get to the picks, because I'm way up front, because I want to look at people in the band. And I'm thinking, well, I'm barefoot. I better stand back, you know, which means I'm not going to get a pick, which kind of sucks. But I'm also not going to have a toenail ripped off by somebody in boots. So I'm standing back, and as my feet settle into the grass, I feel something tip against my foot. I could never have felt it with shoes on. And I look down, and there it is. One of Rick Nielsen's guitar picks, had landed right on top of my foot, which I never would have noticed with shoes on. However, if I'd have had shoes on, I probably wouldn't have a foot covered in fire ant bites. So I guess there's a downside. The second story is really about the times I spent touring on the Renaissance Festival circuit. There's something going on here in the culture that I don't really understand, and that everybody wants to make fun of people who do Ren fairs. I really don't quite get this, you know, because I knew the serious professional Renaissance Fair troops. I got to be pretty good friends with a bunch of them, and these are amazing people. You know, they're like the last vaudevillians on the planet. They're serious traveling gypsies. You know, this is like a real thing with these people. And they're performing all these dying arts and things that other people don't do. So they're an amazing group of people. And they have such an incredible community because they all live in these traveling encampments, which are really spectacular. And I would go to the festivals and get up Monday morning because I knew people in the shows. And they would, all these happy people riding around on bicycles in the sunshine. And I thought, I want this life. This is the life I want to do. I want to tour around with Renaissance festivals and live with these amazing people. So I decided to start this, you know, by starting off with a local Renaissance Fair experience in Cleveland, Ohio. But it was one of those summers where for some reason it was cold and wet, and I just sat in the tent, not making any money. People did not want to buy my art, but there was a guy two tents over that they loved buying from, so they all went there and bought his art. And I started to realize that in order to make this work, I was going to have to appeal to the punters, which meant that I was really going to have to create a bunch of artwork with pictures of green dragon heads and red dragon heads and stuff people could have for tattoos. I don't know what they wanted, but they didn't want what I was selling. But I did have some weird experiences with people coming through. One woman came through, and she said to me, you know, because I wasn't making any money, I had actually kept a list of the top 10 things no vendor wants to hear. And I'll tell you what I got sick of hearing was, nice work. I've got a $2 postcard. Could you just help me get a thing of fries so I can eat tonight? You know, just do your part. Share in this a little. Nice work. So nice work became, like, I knew when someone said nice work, they weren't buying anything. And this was just lip service. But one woman said to me, well, you know, artists are supposed to starve. So, you know, she's standing here and I just kind of did one of these. You know, because at this point, what do you say to a comment like that? But there's a series of sentiments that keep artists down. There are three major ones, and I'm learning this on this tour. One is that those sort of statements perpetuate the misery of artists and perpetuate the myth that we are not valuable. Another thing that perpetuates the misery of artists is that skill doesn't matter. Everyone should express themselves and we're all equal. That doesn't cut it. That creates a total disrespect for artists in the art world. And the other thing is this idea that, like, that we should be starving, that we really shouldn't be making money, and it's a labor of love. Well, let me tell you this. I want a professional artist making my art, and I'm going to hire a professional artist to make my art the same way I would hire a professional surgeon to do heart surgery on me. I don't want a rank amateur or outsider surgeon doing my surgery. So it's just something to think about. Another woman came up to me at my booth once, took a picture of one of my images that's hanging outside my tent, looks at me, giggles, and runs away. Now, I had a postcard of that image that she could have bought for $2. And I thought, to hell with this. So I ran through the fairground after this woman, and I caught her, and I said, do you have any idea what you just did? I said, I had postcards of that image for $2. You stood in front of me, took a photograph of it, and walked away giggling. That means I don't get to eat dinner tonight. Thank you very much. And I went back to my booth. 5 minutes, she came back bawling, just tears streaming down her face. I deleted the picture. I'm so sorry. I never thought of it that way. I feel so awful. And then she walked away without buying a damn thing. Another lesson learned. So, now this story is about how my Renaissance Festival circuit career ended. And like everything else, it ended with an enormous expense that I simply couldn't pay. Kind of like my electric bill and my phone bill. But anyway, I'm out in Vermont with a brand new trailer. Not brand new, it was actually used. It's brand new to me. It was $11,000 for this trailer because I was going to make this work. I had a $2,000 used van that I just bought for my mechanic, so I knew that even though it was cheap, it was reliable. Towed this trailer. I'd never towed a trailer in my life, by the way. I don't look very rednecky. My grandfather knew how to do all this. I didn't have a clue, you know? He tried to show me how to hitch and unhitch the trailer while he had Alzheimer's, which, well, it is, you can laugh. It's pretty funny. It's dangerous. But anyway, it was tragic. But I was coming home from the Ren Fair experience going down the highway, and I'm in the middle of Pennsylvania. I lived in Ohio. The festival's in Vermont or Connecticut or wherever. I just spent 7 weeks living in a trailer on a campground in the fall in Vermont by myself, which, by the way, was spectacular. For some reason, I was the only person living on the campground in the fall in Vermont, so I had this enormous campground to myself, which was pretty amazing. But the trip home was the one that officially ended my Ren Fair career. I'm driving down the road, and I don't know what happens, whether I hear it or I feel it, but suddenly the van stops running. It's just sort of grinding and slowing and not doing anything. And by the way, if you're between Connecticut, if you live in Ohio and you're going to Connecticut, you will break down in the middle of Pennsylvania. It's always in the middle. I have petitioned to have Pennsylvania removed and placed in the ocean so we could just get to New York faster from Ohio, but nobody's taking me seriously. So I get out of my... Finally, I pull off the highway. I get out of my van, and I look at my trailer, and it looked like one of those like alien movies, like the cheap ones, where something spits goo out, and my trailer was covered in pink slime. It was my transmission fluid. Evidently, my transmission had blown up and shot all the fluid all over the trailer. So, okay, now my $2,000 van is shot. And I'm thinking, what's the deal with this trailer, you know? So I call to have a specialty trailer tower come out and take my trailer home for me, which, by the way, this is not cheap. These guys don't work cheap because they are towing trailers all the way across Pennsylvania to your home. Very expensive. And at one point, I'll never forget this guy in this enormous, like, 6-8-wheeled truck towing my trailer. And he's eating a burrito, talking on a cell phone, and talking on the radio at the same time, steering with one knee down the highway, towing my trailer. And I look at him and I said, is that really a good idea? And he said, well, yeah, I do it all the time. And I looked at him again and I said, that doesn't make it a good idea. You know, so we finally get all the way back to Ohio. And then I had to go through the rigors of returning the trailer. And I found out it was sold to me with a bent axle. So I go to the trailer place and the salesman says, sorry, you bought it as is. So now here I am, this poverty-stricken artist, with an $11,000 loan for a trailer that was sold to me with a bent axle, and my van is abandoned in the middle of Pennsylvania. So I'm suddenly reduced to less than nothing. And they won't even budge. The trailer people won't talk to me. So I called the attorney general. and I called a lawyer. And I had letters from the attorney general and from the lawyer sent to the trailer place. I went back in there. The manager came out with a file on me, this thick, with the letters from the attorney general and said, we're ready to settle with you. What do you want? $11,000 in cash in the next 10 minutes. So we sat down in the office. He gave me $11,000 in cash. I walked away with my money, but no, Renaissance Fair, so...
Thanks, Justine. Are you next? Oh my gosh, this is going so much easier than I thought it would. Introduce yourself.
I will. Hi, my name is Mike. A somewhat unimportant detail, when your name is Mike, you're always Mike something, Mike M something. This is another story that's going to take place in Pennsylvania, where I grew up, a couple miles outside of Philadelphia. And it's a bit of a stretch. I was a younger brother, and I was hanging out with my older brother and his friends, so I was going on a tour with my older brother, seeing what his life was like. So he was maybe 16, 17 years old. I was 13, 14. And my brother had a friend from the neighborhood. His name was Dan Rudick. And Dan Rudick was the big, tough kid in the neighborhood. He was the guy you wanted on your softball team. But he had sort of a nervous personality. And my brother and his friends were going to play a joke on him. And I was going to go along on tour as a younger brother. So the idea was that my brother and his friends would dress up with masks, all in black, and have weapons with them, chains and knives. Not to do any harm to Dan Rudick, but because he had this nervous personality, he was this big, tough kid, they thought it would be fun to make this joke on him. So one of the accomplices drove Dan out a couple miles outside of Philadelphia, out into the country a bit, and my brother, myself, and three of my brother's friends, we sort of hid in the bushes alongside the road. So the idea was, it doesn't sound as funny, you know, 25 years later. The idea was is that when Dan, the person who was driving Dan, when their car broke down and they got out to fix the car, we were all going to jump out and scare Dan Rudick, the big tough kid with the nervous personality, and this would have been the joke on him. So we're lying in wait and, you know, planning out our strategy. Dan's car pulls up. They get out as planned. And the sky in all directions lit up, blue and red. There were at least half a dozen, seven, eight cop cars. Apparently someone had seen us, you know, a group of young men dressed in black with masks and weapons hiding in the bushes in their neighborhood. So Dan, the big tough kid with the nervous personality, he gets out of the car. Now there's cops everywhere, and we all kind of come out of the bushes, you know, a little bit sheepishly because we're a little uncertain exactly what's going to happen next. So, you know, the police are basically interrogating us, and I don't know if they had their guns drawn or not, but they were ready for action. They thought there was something happening. So, you know, we sort of explain everything, and it's a joke, and it's really funny, ha, ha, ha. And then they, you know, they do sort of a show to make sure that we understand that we should never have done this, we should never do this again, how serious it was. So the police all leave. And poor Dan Rudick, he was still trying to sort out whether or not, you know, the police were there for him or whether it was real or not. Again, it sounds funny 15 years ago, maybe not as funny now, but that's my story anyway about the night I went out on tour with my older brother and his friends.
Thanks, Mike.
Hi, introduce yourself. Hi, I'm Miranda. I am also from Saw over here. Yeah. So this is a story about the music festival, which is sort of like a tour. I think it was last summer. My older sister always goes to Bonnaroo the big music festival in Tennessee every year, and I've never been. And I decided to go along with her because I could, and it was available to me at the time, and I've never been, and it was really interesting. And my sister and I don't really get along. We fight a lot, and I figured it would be a good bonding experience, and it really wasn't. Because we fought a lot, because when you're in a tent together and it's really hot and crowded and there's stuff going on. Anyway, so I had a great time at the festival, but at one point, someone had brought these cookies. And I was, you know, I knew that the cookies were not just cookies. I knew that the cookies had marijuana in them. And I decided, okay, I'm going to relax. I'm going to take one of these cookies. It's going to be great. I'm going to be really cool. And I ate an entire cookie way too fast, and the whole world was just crashing around me. And I'm not a person who really does drugs a lot. It's not really in my system to handle that. So I was freaking out, and I was really nervous, and I was really nervous because I didn't want to like upset my sister, who this was her ritual every year. She came down to Bonnaroo, and it was a big deal for her. But the next thing I know, we are out of the concert where we were, and I am in a tent. And my sister has this bottle of water for me, and she has like this plate of stir fry that she bought for me. And we never really talked about it, but it was just sort of this nice moment where I realized that my sister really does love me and care about me. And she would rather leave a concert and make sure I'm safe than have her little sister vomiting and freaking out all over the place. So that was a really nice moment.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm John, and I'm a recovering SAW instructor. I guess the other SAW folks here tonight. And some of you guys have heard the story, but I thought I'd tell it anyway. It's sort of a baby tour story. We were trying to adopt my daughter, and it was very complicated. And so we would go up to Fernandina Beach, which is where she was born, and we would go up every Saturday, and we were in charge of Elizabeth during Saturdays, and it was really hot in Florida. You guys know what it's like in the summer. This is in the summer, and so super hot. So we would get a hotel, and we would have bets, and we would take her to the beach and keep her covered, and then we would have to give her back to her grandmother, and then we would go to the hotel, and we would be really sad, and it was hard. We'd go up every Saturday. And we did it for, you know, we sort of slowly drained our bank account, and we found, you know, but we were like committed to doing it. And the lawyers, for our lawyer was really great, but the other lawyer was not. He was this like wired in Republican real estate guy. And so we thought it would go really smooth, but it didn't go smooth at all. He totally screwed it up. Every time our lawyer would give him paperwork, he would like file it wrong or do something wrong with it. It was really, really messed up. And we would just pull in our hair out. We're going crazy. And, so after doing this for about 6 weeks, I had Elizabeth in my arms, actually, and we were about to give her to her grandmother. And our counselor called us, Geraldine Ryan, who is probably the most saintly person in Gainesville. She's really like a saint. I mean, she's literally, if you touch her, you'll realize, oh, yeah, this woman's a saint. So anyway, Geraldine calls us and says, oh, we know you guys wanted to have two kids, and we know you wanted to have a boy, too. So there's this woman in Winter Haven who just gave birth, and we mentioned some families in Tampa, but we mentioned Gainesville, and she jumped at Gainesville. Would you be interested? So we drove back from Fernandina to Gainesville, and it's like a 3-hour ride. It's like the most northern part of Florida you can go to. Like Georgia's right across the water. So we drove back, and we talked about it, and we thought, oh, this will be easy, like two kids at the same time. This will be totally easy. Oh, yeah, it'll be super, super easy. Oh, this is a really good idea. Like, we talked ourselves into it. Like, this is a great idea. So we said, yeah, as long as it doesn't interfere with Elizabeth's adoption, we would like to move forward with this. And she said, well, as far as Catholic Charities is concerned, that's fine, but you need to talk to your lawyer. So we called our lawyer, and the lawyer said, yeah, you know, it's totally legal to do this, but I think you're fucking crazy. And it was like the first time our lawyer had ever said anything like that to us. Like, he was super professional. He was like, I think you're fucking crazy. So anyway, it was the beginning of the term. It was literally the beginning of it was the week before I had to train all the grad students. And so my job was to train the grad students how to teach my syllabus. I was teaching tech writing, and here's how you teach tech writing. And, you know, all these brand new MA students, I had to teach them how to teach, really. And I was supposed to do it in the afternoons, but I couldn't. I had to do it in the morning. So they readjusted the schedule and let me train people in the morning. And then my wife and I would leave campus at noon, and we would drive down to Winter Haven. So now we're going like 3 hours south. And so every time So we did it the first time on Monday. Daniel was born on Sunday. We went down there on Monday, and we drove for 3 hours, and we get to the NICU. We meet Daniel, and he's really tiny, really, really small. He's a premature baby. And we stayed there from 3 until they kicked us out at 6 o'clock, and they said, you can come back tomorrow. And we're really freaked out, like, oh, is this really going to happen? So on Tuesday, we did the same thing. We worked in the morning, and then we would get in the car, and we would drive to Winter Haven, which is like south of Orlando and Tampa. It's like really, it used to be where the Red Sox did their spring training, but they don't train there anymore. And that was like, oh, you were born with, anyway. So we would drive every day, Monday, and then we did it Tuesday, and then we did it Wednesday, and we were really freaked out. Like, is this really going to happen? Is this like going to be a repeat of Elizabeth's long, drawn-out thing? And so, and then on Wednesday night, they said, oh, you can come back tomorrow, and you can stay over. Bring a change of clothes, because you can stay over tomorrow night. So we drove down on Thursday, and we didn't want to tell our families or anything because we didn't want to, like, spook it or freak it out, you know, like, oh, nothing. So we didn't say anything to anybody, just our friends. Our friends knew, and that was it, and none of our families knew. So anyway, we stayed overnight at the Winter Haven Center with Daniel Thursday night, and we held him in our arms, and it was really great. It was like, okay, this is really going to happen. We can really feel this is going to happen. And then Friday morning they came, and they said, here's a paperwork, and you just sign this paperwork. And, okay, now you are the temporary custodian parent of Daniel Ronan. And so we were so happy. We were, like, totally happy. And we were using the Eclipse. We had this small little Eclipse so because we didn't want to use a lot of gas because we were really poor. And so we get in the Eclipse, and we drive all the way back to Florida. And now on the way home to Gainesville, we are calling our families. Oh, hey, guess what? We have a surprise. And my mom was like, oh, so Elizabeth is happening? And I said, oh, no, actually, you have a new grandson. And everybody was really happy, and that was totally cool. So we brought Daniel into the house, and we literally get into the house in Gainesville, and Elizabeth's grandmother calls us and says, the judge signed the order. You can come up and get Elizabeth. So our tour story was that we did a summer of touring in Fernandina and Winter Haven, and on that day, we began our family. Thanks.
I just want to add that John said he was bringing his children here tonight, so we weren't allowed to cuss. So I was really, really careful about what I said, and he said fucking twice in his story. So I just wanted to kind of bring that out.
So any more on tour? Okay, Fred.
Hi, I'm Fred. Many years ago, when I was still in college at Syracuse, this was in the, I guess it was like 1986 or 87, I was working for the JVC Jazz Festival, and I was working in New York and in Newport and in Saratoga, and in New York, we were at Lincoln Center at Avery Fisher Hall. And on one night, I worked production, mostly just backstage helping, on a show with Miles Davis and Spyro Gyra. I guess y'all can remember, some of you can remember Spyro Gyra. I wish I didn't sometimes. Anyway, it was a double show. So Spyro Gyra opened and Miles Davis played, and then there was a long break. And then Spyro Gyra played again. Actually, no, they switched it up. And then Miles Davis played, and then Spyro Gyra played. So during the break, I was being lazy and not doing what I was supposed to be doing. And someone screamed at me, go see what if Miles wants anything. So I go up the stairs into his dressing room. And I open the door. And I see 10 Japanese guys sitting around a table and no Miles Davis. And then I see Miles has a manservant. And so I said, where's Mr. Davis? And he goes, he's in the closet. So I walk over through the dressing room to the closet, and I open the door. It's dark in the closet. And I don't know if you remember Miles Davis, but he's a very, very dark man. You know, I mean, well, in more ways than one. But in appearance-wise, he's very black in his coloring. So all I see is Miles' eyes coming out from underneath the clothing racks, which, you know, Miles Davis travels with a range of sequins and outfits. And I say, "Mr. Davis, is there anything I can get you?" And he says to me, "Bring my Japanese friends some more champagne." And that's my story.
Thanks, Fred. So on tour, anybody else?
Hi, my name is Rachel. Last December, my partner and I took a trip to Southeast Asia. We were spending 3 weeks and visiting a number of countries. We decided that we would take a flight path that would put us through Japan for an overnight. That wasn't our primary destination, but yeah, it would be great. We can see Japan for a night. So leading up to the trip, I had been sick for about a month. So I had severe sinus problems and stuffy ears, and really bad for long flights. So I had been visiting my doctor, and they finally gave me some prednisone, which is a steroid, and it tends to keep people awake at night. Yeah. So I was happy with the prednisone. It was really working. It was really great. And actually, we decided that the plan would be for us to stay up all night prior to our flight, because we were leaving really early in the morning. And if we stayed up all night, then we could sleep on the flight. It was 14 hours to Japan. So I was up all night. And I was on my prednisone. And I was up on the flight. And I was up on the flight. And I was up on the flight. It was 14 hours. And when we got to Japan, it was very immediately an odd culture shock when you walk into the airport. Everything is silent. Very strange feeling walking into a new culture. So, of course, I was in a daze, not having slept now for 48 hours. It had been since I slept. So we were standing there looking at the boards where all the bus schedules are and the train schedules are, trying to figure out where we needed to go. Just staring at the schedules. I'm like, I don't know what I'm looking at. And all of a sudden, I see, is this stage left? I don't know. I see this microphone enter my visionary field. I'm like, what's this? And there's this Japanese man with a microphone, and he's saying, "Hello, welcome to Japan." And I'm like, "Hello." And I'm looking up at Mike, and I'm going, "What's happening? There's a man with a camera and a microphone in my face. Can we interview you?" And I'm looking up at Mike. Like, okay. He says, "So, what brings you to Japan?" And he's through an interpreter, actually. He didn't actually speak English. He was translating Japanese to some other man who spoke English. And I said, "Well, going in my mind, you know, okay, well, I can't really be honest with this guy. Like, okay, we're just passing through. Like, I'm not going to tell him, like, okay, we're just, like, here for the night. Sorry, thanks. I know you guys are great, too, but we're just passing through." And, no, I'm like, "No, I'm not going to say that. And what brings you to Japan?" I'm like, "Okay, well, you know, we had thought about coming to Japan, but you had, like, a little nuclear disaster. I'm not going to say that either." So I'm like, he's not saying anything. Somebody's got to say something. There's a camera in front of our face. So I just start saying, "I have to apologize to all of you on behalf of myself. I have to apologize for what I did to Americans in front of that cameraman," because I started saying things like, "Well, you know, Japan is like, okay, hold on, 48 hours without sleep, okay, and prednisone." And I'm saying, "Well, because Japan is like America's sister." "Yeah, I love Japan." And a lot of other similar things came out of my mouth, and I wasn't sure what exactly they were afterwards, but I walked away in a daze and quite traumatized. And my partner forgave me. Of course, when we were headed back on the flight, you know, 3 weeks later, had thankfully had many other experiences to sort of wash it away. And Micah's on the flight in Japan going, "Hey, look at this program on TV. It's called Why I Came to Japan." And they really do air those things.
Man, now I'm just wondering, I was in China a couple years ago, and in one particular city, I had a couple similar experiences, and now I'm just wondering who got to watch those, and what embarrassing things I said.
Hi, I'm Mark. I'm going to tell you about it, and just settle in, it's going to take a minute to get there, but I'm going to tell you how I did not set fire to the Everglades. That's a key. I'm going to wander a little bit, but it will come together. So I have this friend who lives in Belgium. We see each other about once a year at some conference somewhere in the world. We always schedule a few extra days afterwards. We go hiking or camping or do something fun together. Usually he and his partner and a group of people get together, usually some of my students, his students. So this one year, I didn't have the budget to go traveling, so but it turns out he was coming to the Breakers Hotel, very fancy hotel down in South Florida, for a conference. And at the end of the conference, he said, "Well, why don't we get together and hike in Orlando?" Well, that's not really going to happen. We're not hiking in Orlando. But I said, you know, the thing is in Belgium, fishing is not really a huge thing, right? It's the North Sea. It's really cold. They don't go out fishing. But I have a little boat that I take down to the Keys every once in a while. Took down to the Keys every once in a while. And so I said, well, here's what I'll do. Is I will drive down at the end of the conference. I'll pick you and your student up at the Breakers. And we'll go down to the Keys. And we'll fish for the weekend. And then I'll drop you off in Orlando. And you can have fun with the whole Orlando scene. So this is a great plan, right? We're all good. Everybody's excited about it. So the background here is I am a freak about trailering my boat, right? I live about 45 minutes out of Gainesville. I used to come into Gainesville to the University of Florida campus every day. But before I would pull my boat anywhere, I would grease everything up. I had not one but two spare tires that I carried with me everywhere. New equipment on it every year. And I hadn't pulled my trailer in about a year, so I figured, well, I'm going to go through everything, did everything there was to do. My boss calls me and says, "Mark, I need you to come in and teach a class for me." And, of course, it's that very morning, right? So I'll start doing the time. Well, if I leave Gainesville by noon, I can be done teaching class, leave Gainesville by noon, get down to South Florida, pick this guy up. So I hook up my trailer, come into town, everything's going great. I got the van is loaded up with all the fishing gear. Everything's looking great. This is going to be a fantastic day. I'm going to teach this class, a bunch of students in the lab. It's going to be a blast. Then I'm going to hit the road and go fishing. I mean, you could, for a geek like me, you can't have a better day than that. So I'm pulling into the O'Connell Center parking lot, right? Now, I know I've got a boat behind me, but it's early in the morning. I'm going to take up two spaces, take my ticket. It's $30 to park my boat. And that's the way I was looking at it. Now, as I'm coming 5 miles an hour, and I remember I've driven 30 miles now, no problem, everything's fine. I come around the corner in the parking lot, 5 miles an hour, I feel a thump. I look in my rear view mirror on the left side in time to see my boat passing me in the O'Connell Center lot on the left side. I'm very clever, so I say, this is a problem. The problem is, now you would think, now this is the student lot, right? And people have seen what students drive on campus, right? Now, you would think if I have a boat on its own traveling through the O'Connell Center lot that it's going to hit a 1973 Tercel, right? A Lexus and a Mercedes, both. I saw it. It was in front of me when it did this, so I could see it. It's boom. And then it like angled itself back to take the shot at the Mercedes before it came to a halt. I'm a calm guy. I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to have to get the boat. Now, the funny thing was the boat wasn't on the trailer anymore. It was on its own. The trailer is still attached to the van. So my boat is now sitting lodged against a Mercedes in the O'Connell Center lot with no water anywhere near. This is a problem. But, all right, we can solve this. Now, do you think that this was an exciting day for the University Police Department? Not to disparage those wonderful saviors of our safety, but, you know, the first guy came in, he sees, you know, immediately takes assessment, he's got everything under control. I look at him and I say, you know, I understand that this is probably something a little bit funny, and so if you want to take a moment and call everybody and come over and look, and he goes, I'm doing it now. I'm not making that up. He really said that. In the little short, I'm doing it now. So next thing I know, every cop on campus is in the O'Connell Center parking lot as if my boat is some sort of fugitive trying to escape the law, which apparently it was just trying to escape my van. By then I've established some rapport with this guy. And trust me, I'm getting to the Everglades. I've established some rapport with the guy who got there first. He actually helps me. We unhitch the trailer and we pry the boat away from the Mercedes, and we're using the trailer like a lever. We're very, very engineering oriented, and we're just doing this thing. We get the boat back up on the trailer, hook it up. The problem, I'm supposed to be teaching a class, right? So one of my students walks past me, and I said, listen, this is supposed to be a two-hour class. We're going to make it a one-hour class. I'm going to be over there in about 30 minutes. I need you to go up there and just make sure nobody leaves because we have to get this class done. So, all fine. We've gotten that taken care of. We got the boat back on the trailer. You know, they call the chief of the university police department, who takes 45 minutes to go through the book to figure out how I'm going to get a ticket for my boat coming off the trailer. Now, remember, I'm a freak about trailering my boat. Right, so everything is tied on the boat. I had bought brand new straps and chains and everything else. She looks at me and she says, you have an improperly secured load. And I said, they're brand new straps. And she goes, well, they didn't work, did they? That's logic you can't argue with, right? So we get the boat back on. I've got my ticket. I've got my keys. I look. I've got every cop on the planet is looking around me. Where are you going to park that boat, son? Well, certainly wasn't planning to park it in this lot where it just hit a Mercedes and a Lexus. So I went and paid $30 in some lot to park my boat and ran back to class, taught my class. I go tell the administrative assistant this story, which by now is funny, right? And I said, Ludi, this is actually going to be a pretty good day, right? Because what else could go wrong? She says, you're not going. I said, I'm on my way. I'm stopping by the shop on the way out. I'm going to get a little fiberglass repair kit. I'm going to get some new straps and extra ones and chains. And I'm going to lock everything down. And that's exactly what I did. I hooked everything up and I head down the interstate. And by now I'm pushing the time limit, right? I need to be there. These are people from Belgium who have no place to stay tonight, and they're in Fort Lauderdale waiting for me. So I get, and now most of you probably have been down the turnpike in Florida. So you know there's this stretch between Orlando and Yeehaw Junction, which I just love the name of, right? Yeehaw. It's 53 miles between the last exit for Orlando and Yeehaw Junction on the turnpike. And there is nothing but the northern edge of the swamp that eventually becomes the Everglades. 21 miles, and I know this because I drove it several times, 21 miles into that 53, I hear, no problem. I got a flat tire on the trailer. I know that sound. I've got not one. I got two spare tires. I've got the jack. I'm all set. I got the wrenches. I jump out of the van. This is no problem. You know, considering the morning, this is easy. I look back, and you know, it's from me to this table, back to the back of the boat. And I look back, and on the other side of the trailer, I can look through the crack, and I see that, sure enough, there's no tire. There's no rim. There's no hub that the rim attaches to, and the axle is bent 90 degrees, pointing back behind the boat like a tail. I didn't have that part with me. I didn't bring an extra trailer for my trailer. So that's all right. I'm calm. I'm cool. I'm collected. This is a solvable problem. Instantly, I came to the conclusion, this boat is not going to the Keys. Right? So I have gear in the boat that's valuable. I'm not going to leave it on the side of the highway. This is pre-cell phone days, right? So I load everything in the car. I unhitch the boat, not really caring if anybody steals it at this point. I leave it on the side of the highway, and I pull 40 feet down the road, and I say, you know, I just glanced at this from here to there. I'm going to feel like a real idiot if I just misinterpreted something. I just can't imagine how that axle could be bent 90 degrees backwards. Before I go 22 miles to Yeehaw Junction and find somebody to come back and fetch my boat, if it's still here, I'm going to just go back there and look. You're right. This is the point where I did not burn down the Everglades, because that axle had been bent 90 degrees back. I walk back to the boat. There's a fire the size of this stage around that axle where it had kicked up a spark. We were in the middle of the terrible droughts at the time, and it's growing. And I'm out there with my size 12s going, oh, God, oh, God, because if this gets going, it's going to Fort Myers. There's nothing between here and Fort Myers but tinder. So I did not set the Everglades, and I'm feeling pretty good about that. I got the fire out. This is a good day, right? I get to Yeehaw Junction. I make the arrangement for the tow truck. I call my wife, and I say, you would not believe the day I've been having. But it's okay. I'm heading to the Keys. I'm going to rent a boat. And I've found this great tow truck driver who's going to pick up my boat and then drive around the county for the next week and find all the parts, and I'm going to come back down and pick it up. And I'm this is out on payphone, and I had just bought 44 ounces, treated myself because I needed the caffeine at that point, treated myself to 44 ounces of Coke, and I sat down in the van. And my hand went, and 44 ounces of Coke absorbed from here to here. Not a drop anywhere else. From here to here. The Coke is what pissed me off.
Thanks, Mark.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jenny. I am also from the Sequential Artists Workshop. Go Saw. Story I'm going to tell tonight is kind of embarrassing. Kind of had to drink, I don't know, 3/4 of a beer to, you know, liquid courage. So this story takes place around when I was in 10th grade. My friends and I, at the time, we joined this club, Youth in Government. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. For the purposes of a free trip to Tallahassee. So the trip there wasn't so bad until we got to our hotel room. You know, an hour in, apparently like our toilet wouldn't flush. I guess the chain broke. So, okay. So right before we were going out to get dinner, we noticed a tiny puddle on the floor. It's no big deal. We went out to dinner. Don't really remember what exactly we did. got dinner, came back, noticed the puddle got bigger. So we decided to, like, dry it off, and then, you know, one roll of toilet paper later, we decided, oh, you know, this isn't working. So me, being the genius that I am, decided that, oh, you know, why not iron the floor? Because, you know, heat evaporates. You know, with heat, water will evaporate. So, yeah, I spent, like, I don't know, good 10 minutes ironing the floor. And my friend Stephanie was all like, what's that smell? Turns out that the puddle was because of a leaky faucet or a drain. And there you go. That is a story about the one time I ironed the floor. Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny.
All right. Hi, my name is Mike, as that other guy was. Yeah, I'm also from Saw. Fantastic place, whatnot. I don't know if this really counts as a tour story so much that I would go to school and back, and I would do a round trip, so maybe that's a tour. But it's not so much about that. It's about this one time when I was up for 5 days straight because of exams and Adderall. But, yeah, that was fun. Yeah. So on day three, going strong, no sleep, who needs that? I think it was the English final or something. I don't know. I just did it all night. So I'm driving the same way I always go, and I always go through this one terrible, 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 terrible intersection where you have to take this left, and the lights are kind of weird, and it's like the one spot in the whole town where everybody has a wreck every day. So I'm like pulling into the left lane to make my left turn, as I always do, and there's this really old pickup truck in front of me, and I'm like, whatever. That's just, you know, I'll just pull him behind him. He came to a really, really abrupt stop, and I had to do the same thing. And I was like, oh, wow, that was really close. And I'm like right on his bumper almost. And I was like, whew, that was really close. Okay, well, that's fine, whatever. I'll just pay more attention now. 3 days, whatever, no sleep. So, you know, the light finally turns green, and I let off the brake. And he doesn't. And he has this hitch on the back of his truck comes off, I don't know, 37 feet or so. And it just plows straight into the front of my front fender. And I'm like, oh, God, what's happened? You know, because I've been up for 3 days, and I'm like, what is happening right now? It's like, I was so careful. Because I was driving really, really careful. I hate driving in general. And it's like, he's not moving. Should I get out and do something? So I call my dad, because I didn't know what to do. And I was like, Dad, I kind of just bumped into some guy on the road, and he's not moving, and people are, you know, we're causing a real big pileup of traffic. What should I do? And he's like, well, get out and go talk to the guy and see about pulling off the side of the road if you can. And again, we're in the middle of this, like, six-lane intersection on all sides, so there's no way that's going to happen. So I get out, and I go up to the guy, and I see him, and he's, like, this huge guy, and he's got nothing on but overalls. And his wife is in there. I assume it was his wife. And they have this little kid who's, like, bouncing all over the place in the car. And it's like, okay. He's making, like, a lot of really animalistic noises. I'm like, all right, well, I'll ignore that. And, excuse me, sir. I didn't mean to bump you there. It doesn't look like there's any damage. Neither one of us is scratched. Maybe we could just call this bygones and get out of the road so we don't bother people? No. Well, me and my wife, we called the cops about 5 minutes ago. Great. So it's like, okay, well, we kind of need to get out of the middle of the road. Maybe we could go over to the CVS parking lot over there in the meantime. So we do that. And I call my dad, and he's like, okay, so the guy called the cops. And he's like, all right, well, I'll handle it. I'm like, I don't know how you're going to do that, but whatever. I'll just wait till you show up. So the cop shows up, and my dad shows up at the same time, and they all have this conversation. I'm just sitting there like, I'm missing my English final right now. There's no makeup exams for that. I'm not going to pass that class now. Oh, well. I really wish I could sleep right now, but God, I'm wired. So that all resolved itself, sort of, and they gave me, like, a warning. I mean, literally, my truck took more damage than his. So I don't know why that had to happen. And then later that day, my dad... Or no, I forgot to mention, like, when the guy got out of the truck to talk, his wife and his son got out with him, too, and they had the kid on the leash, which I thought was kind of odd. Anyway, but so this guy gets out, and he's like, I'm pretty tall. I'm like 6'1" ish or so. And this guy gets out, and he's, like, up here. I was like, oh, no, he's going to eat me. But anyway, so they the whole thing got resolved, and there was no ticket given. And then I go to school, and I'm like, can I do anything for the makeup exam? No. Cool. So that was a fun thing. And then later that day, my dad tells me that the guy showed up at his job because he'd given him, like, all his information. It's like, you know, if there's any problem with your truck or whatever, come to call me or whatever. So he shows up at my dad's job. He's like, so how much money are you going to give me there for not pressing charge against your boy? And my dad looks at him. He's like, all right, how much money do you want? He's like, I was thinking about $200 or so. He's like, I'll give you $50. In fact, I'll write you a check for it right now. And he handed him the check, and he's like, and if you ever show up again and ask for money, I'll have that as proof to the cops. So, there you go.
Thanks, Mike.
Introduce yourself. Okay. I'm Alice. I wasn't anticipating on telling a story, but some of you guys got me thinking about my innocent little brother, who is not here, so I can, of course, tell a story at his expense. And I guess it is a story of city kids touring upstate New York, by which I mean just like any part of New York that is above New York City. So we're children, city kids, and it's like this idyllic winter day, and my parents think like, oh, let's go upstate, like you guys will love it, it'll be great. And we're driving, and my brother is like pretty little kid, probably kindergarten, and he's like, Dad, I really have to pee, like pull over the car. So we pull over, and like I said, it's the middle of winter, so my brother starts to pee. And if any of you guys have peed in the winter, it evaporates and gets steamy. And so my dad rolls down the window, and he's like, Ajax, your penis is on fire. And so my poor little brother is like dancing around, freaking out that his little penis is on fire. And my mother is just glaring at him like, Gary, I cannot believe that you would do that. Like, what an asshole. So he gets back in the car. We resume our idyllic vacation. And, you know, we're pretty hard on my brother. And so later we're like taking a little walk in the wilderness, which obviously we love. Not really. And my brother sees his first, I guess, like his first real wildlife that wasn't a rat, and it's a deer, and it's like poking its head out of behind like a tree, and my brother just starts to sob because he's terrified of the deer. And that is it.
Thanks, Alice. I guess if I had never seen a deer before, it might be scary. Any more for on tour? I feel like almost everybody's told a story already. I know there are a couple out there.
Hello. Hi, my name is Allison. And I'm really excited to be at this event. I saw it at the last second on Facebook and came out. So the moth is one of my favorite things, and this is sort of like that. So anyway, this is sort of like, I guess, a fangirl on tour story. I was young-ish and had a lot of extra money from financial aid. And I decided to take it and go on a trip over the summer and sort of backpack the U.S. And my big treat to myself at the end of the summer was to go to New York. And Paul Simon, ever since I was probably 14 and got my first mixtape, has been my favorite singer-songwriter ever. And so at the end of the summer, my big birthday present to myself was to buy a backstage access pass to see him at a concert in New York in the Hamptons. And that's not my usual milieu. I'm not from there. But I've heard about it, and so it was interesting. So I get to New York, I rent a car, I drive there all by myself, and go, and it's on the ranch. And so I not really knowing anything about where I was or what I was doing, I was wearing, you know, just sort of shorts and t-shirt, and go to this, because I'm thinking it's like a ranch, you know, horses, people working, I don't know, like I wasn't thinking, because it was the Hamptons. And so I get there, and first of all, you know, I'm one of the youngest people there, which is fine, you know, I was there for adventure. But yes, it was nominally a ranch owned by Paul Simon, I believe. So they had like hay bales as decoration to like sit on and stuff. But then, of course, it was this very beautiful like tents and catered and champagne and all of this stuff. And it was really nice. And it was not what I was expecting, but it was very nice. And but I did feel slightly out of place, and really was just a dork in there for the music. And so I was really excited because there were like special guests, and Jimmy Buffett went on stage, and Lyle Lovett, and it was really exciting. But in between the acts, I was bored because I was there by myself, and really, like, I did not fit in. So I hung out sort of like in the tent area, like where there were some merch tables. And I was like, merch tables, I understand that. Like, I'll go hang out over there. And there were some younger people, more my age, some young girls, like maybe 20 or something. And so I'm talking to them, and like, you know, they were off school for the summer, and I was off school for the summer, and we're talking about that, and you know, where do you go? I go to UF, blah 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 blah, and they, you know, some of them were off from Columbia, and they're like, oh well, there's a party later tonight, do you want to go? And you know, I don't know them, but I'm up for anything, I'm traveling, so all right. And they're like, yeah, it's over, you know, at, you know, the house, and you should come. And I really am I'm quite clueless, and because one of them's was talking about how she went to Columbia, and like, because her dad went or something or other. And they're like, oh yeah, my dad was Art's roommate. And I'm like, they're talking like I should know who these people are. I'm like, I have no idea who Art is. Like, because I'm so dumb. So, and they're like, oh yeah, so you should come back. It's at Paul's house. We'll just like go to the party. And I'm like, okay, who's Paul? Like, I should know who Paul is. And I'm just, because I'm thinking a 20-year-old college party. That's what I'm thinking. Like, oh, you know, a beer keg, red cups, and pizza. That's what I was thinking. And so, like, they're like, yeah, come meet us out in the parking lot afterwards. And I did. And I waited till everybody cleared out, because that's what they asked me to do. And this sort of short little guy comes out, and he starts, like, pointing people to move their cars this way. And I look at him, and I'm like, holy shit, that is Paul Simon pointing people where to park their cars. And I was like, oh my God, is that who Art and Paul were? Is that what they're talking about? And I was so excited. I thought my heart was going to, like, you know, literally come out of my chest. And I was able to calm down sufficiently enough to, like, I had all my, like, you know, stuff in the car. So I, like, changed in the car to try to look a little less ridiculous. And so I went to the party, and it was Paul Simon's house, and it was really exciting. And he was very shy, so I tried to talk to him, but he's a very shy guy, but seemed very polite. And sort of the kicker to the story is, though, that, like, you know, it was quite wide generationally for the party, so, like, most of the older folks were hanging out, and I was hanging out with all the younger folks. And it's just sort of funny that sort of, like, family craziness and family dysfunction happens no matter where you are, because I was hanging out with the girls who invited me to the party. I guess got in trouble for, like, inviting me to the party because, like, I was nobody or whatever, and but they were very polite about it, but, like, I sort of heard about it on the side, but I tried to be polite and appropriate, and so nobody seemed to care. But then the one girl who was sort of the wild girl, like, I guess I was hanging out with her and another young man who I later found out was Paul Simon's, like, cousin's brother or something. Anyway, like, they ran off to the pool and told me not to tell. And I was like, wow, I just got stuck in some kind of the middle of something that I don't know what is going on. And literally, I had to be, like, the stranger who comes in and, like, tells the truth or whatever, because, like, they were hiding and couldn't be found for, like, 2 hours. So I finally had to, like, I guess I was the only one who knew and had to come up and, like, tell Paul and Edie, his wife, like, yeah, the kids are over, like, there, and they're in the pool, and then I guess I was thanked for being there, and I wasn't such an imposition or whatever. It was a really, really bizarre night, and I felt like I'd been transported to, like, a weird magical land. And then I just sort of left and drove back, but that was, like, just my weird, surreal evening at Paul Simon's house. So, thanks.
Thanks, Allison. I'm glad you found your way there, and I'm glad you found your way here. Anyone else for on tour?
This is super short, so I know I've been up here twice. Well, three times, actually. But just pretend you've never seen me before. I was at a Beatles convention because I'm a huge fanatic, and Pete Best was actually touring around doing music tours and doing these shows. If you don't know who he is, Pete Best was the original drummer for the Beatles back in the Cavern Club days. Well, I had gone to the convention with the promoter, basically, and I had just bought a 5-foot-tall, life-size promotional cardboard cutout of Ringo Starr, who had replaced Pete Best, if you don't know the history. So it came around to where we had to drive me and Pete Best back to the hotel. Now, I had never been in a room with Pete Best before, you know, so this was like a big thrill, you know, because this is like real part of Beatles history. And then I was ushered out to the car, and we were going to go out to the room. And picture this. It's the driver, Pete Best in the seat next to him, and me and a life-size cutout of Ringo Starr in the back seat.
Thanks. We've got time for maybe one or two more. All right, Phil.
Your Paul Simon story brought this one back, and I'm not trying to top you because it won't top you, but I went to Burning Man a while back, and it always happens on Labor Day weekend, and it happens in Nevada, and the way I had chosen to go that year was to take an RV from Florida to Nevada and then to come all the way back. And so I was on the road, including the time there, for about 3 weeks, maybe a little longer. And I'd left Burning Man. That's not what the story's about. But I had to leave early because my body was sort of reacting terribly to the desert. It's an alkali desert, and it's a different kind of material. It's not sand. It's like powder, and you have these dust storms and rainstorms, and it can be just a really miserable place. And it had gotten in my eyes, and the wind is really bad out there. And I just by the second or third day, I just couldn't see anymore, so I couldn't stay. So I took off, and I took off on the Sunday, I guess it was, before Labor Day Monday. And I'd gotten to, or maybe I took off on, I took on Saturday. I got to Denver on Sunday to visit a friend. I hadn't seen this friend in, God, 10 years or so. But I thought, you know, I'll take this trip home and take a little detour and go visit some friends. And so I wind up in Denver on Sunday, and I wind up in a house where my friend lived with two roommates. And the two roommates were a couple that had just gotten married the day before. And so I get to this house on Sunday, and it's, you know, before noon, so things are still moving kind of slow at this house. They'd had a really great wedding and a great reception, and so the sort of after effects were what I was walking into. Well, on top of all that, the groom and his best friend had gotten a call that after the wedding telling them they'd both lost their jobs. Just to, you know, cap off a beautiful weekend. You got no job to go to on Tuesday. So they were all kind of moping around on Sunday afternoon, and I wasn't really aware of their state, but I could sort of appreciate it. And the groom's friend, I can't even remember his name, kind of pops up out of the gloom and says, you know, we could sit around here and mope all day or all next couple of days, or we could go up to my uncle's place in the mountains tonight and spend a few days up there and chill out and get over this and just enjoy ourselves. And this is probably about eight or so people, maybe 10 people. And so by evening, we all pile in vehicles and start heading up into the mountains. And it's dark, so I don't really know where I'm going. I just kind of fell asleep and wake up in the morning and wake up in this unbelievably idyllic setting. You've got we're in the middle of a valley. There's two alpine lakes. I'm in a giant log cabin. And there's an alpine lake above us, an alpine lake below us. There's all these little wooden log cabin cottages all around us. And come to find out, we're staying in John Denver's house. And it's his compound that he got that was originally established by Teddy Roosevelt as his private hunting lodge. And so it's this unbelievable place. And it had a weird kind of vibe to it for me, only because my family growing up, it was not a very musical family, but the music that my parents did listen to, they listened to a lot, and it was John Denver and Neil Diamond. So I have just about every John Denver song burned into my brain, and so this is having a weird effect on me while I'm in this place. This is after he's dead, so it's also kind of sentimental and nostalgic because he's gone now. And so we spent a few days there, and among those things we did while we were there was go fishing using John Denver's tackle box, go out and ride John Denver's horses, go up and check out John Denver's hydroelectric plant that powers the whole thing, and sit on his denim couch and listen. And the crazy thing was that the nephew listened to John Denver music, played it the whole time we were there, too, so it was the soundtrack to the whole weekend. And so the story is not much more interesting than that, except for just how weird it was for me to be there. But the one kind of exciting thing that happened while we were there, which was, I guess, could have been a near-death experience, we got to go on a horseback ride. And these are, you know, Western saddles. This is steep mountain grades where these paths are. And the person who's sort of leading us on this horse ride doesn't even bother to ask anybody if they've ever ridden a horse before, which I thought was a big oversight. And and the day, it was kind of a nice day, but this is, you know, September in the mountains, so it's kind of chilly. And so we start riding up into the mountains, and I pick out this one horse which looks really nice, and I had ridden a lot growing up, so I felt like I was confident and comfortable on horses. And so I pick out this horse that looks great, and the leader's getting everybody settled on all their horses, and I'm waiting to get on mine, and she comes over and says, "Oh, that's my horse. I'm going to be riding that one. You got to ride this one over here." And I turn around, and it's this very old, very tired-looking horse, and I'm thinking, "Oh, man, of course I picked the best one, and I wind up with the worst one." So I get on this horse, and I start walking with him, and I start kind of getting some rapport with this horse, and I'm thinking we are developing this kind of bond. He's older, I'm kind of older. He's tired, I'm kind of tired. And we're walking up in the mountains, and I'm sort of at the back of the line. We're all single file line, 10 or 12 horses. And the horses start getting tense while they're walking. And I don't know if you've ridden or not, but when you're on a horse and it starts getting tense, you can feel it. It's intense. It's a very strong, muscular animal, and when they start getting agitated, you know something's going on. And so all the horses are getting agitated, and I'm looking around trying to find out what's making them so kind of on alert. And I see a flash of brown fur in the trees. There's just dense green leaves and trees all around us, so there's not a lot of room to see through them. And this flash of brown fur is something I see, and my first thought is, "Oh shit, it's a mountain lion." And I'm thinking, if it is a mountain lion, then we're all doomed because these horses are just going to take off running and we're just going to wind up rolling down the mountains, because it's literally like a 60-degree grade off to the side. And it has started raining, so it's a little slippery as well. And there's switchbacks, so there's sharp turns to go back and forth to get down the mountain. And so I'm just kind of waiting for the axe to fall, and turns out it was cows. hadn't heard of taking cows in the mountains, but that's what it was, thankfully, and we made it all the way back down and enjoyed the rest of our weekend at John Denver's cabin.
Thanks, Bill. I feel like I've known people in my life who have referred to John Denver for whatever reason as Uncle John, and that just like brings a whole new dimension to it. He really was an Uncle John. So, any more stories about On Tour? All right, come on.
Hey guys, my name is Caitlin. I've been coming to this for about a year, and now I've finally come up on stage, and this is kind of terrifying, but it's okay, because I've had a lot to drink. So anyway, I went to Taiwan about a year and a half ago, in between undergrad and graduate school to teach English, and one of the classes I taught there when I was in Taiwan was kindergarten. There's three levels of kindergarten in Taiwan, and I had the youngest class, so it was 2 to 3 year olds. I had never, ever, ever interacted or much less spoken to children before I had gone over there, and so it was a very different experience to suddenly have one of my full-time jobs being to teach English to a class of 17 2 to 3 year old children who didn't speak my language. So it was a bit of a learning curve, but after a couple of weeks, I super fell in love with them. They were tiny, cute little kids. I feel like Asian people in general are arguably the most gorgeous members of humanity ever, and then you shrink them down to tiny size and they're adorable. And so I fell in love with all of them. There's this one girl, Claire, who I super adored. She reminded me, mainly because she reminded me of my little sister, Chloe. When she was little, they both had this bowl cut, like Beatles bowl cut haircut, and called me Kay Cullen instead of Caitlin, because the consonants thing was a problem with them. And so I super adored her. One day, I think the thing that most stuck out in my memory of her was it was probably like a couple weeks I was teaching, and the kids, for snack time, they have to eat a lot, you know. The parents want them to eat a lot so they can grow, and they have to kind of get in the habit of eating, you know, 3 meals a day. And Claire had eaten a lot. She was super tiny, and she looks over at me, and I've see that she's gotten a little sick, and she's looking at me, and she starts walking towards me, and all of a sudden, she gets sick. And I'm like, oh no, Claire, it's okay, it's okay. And she's crying and she's crying. And then she falls over into, unfortunately, her pile of vomit. The worst part is, unfortunately, though, that she gets up and, seeing the only person that's being sympathetic to her situation, starts running towards me. And this is the part that I feel most guilty about, is instead of comforting her, cleaning her up, I run away. Close the door and run to the bathroom and wait for 3 to 5 minutes until I think that she'll probably be done looking for me as any type of parental figure. And that was one of my first experiences abroad.
Thanks, Caitlin. All right, so last chance for to share your On Tour story. All right, well, once more, this is The Conk. Like us on Facebook to find out what next month's theme is. Do we... Hold on, we know what it is. It's on the postcard that I think Bill has distributed to your tables. Huh?
Pets and companions.
Pets and companions. Pets and companions. And it will be on the second Tuesday of November, which is the 11th. I'm very prepared this evening. So please join us again on the 11th for Pets and Companions. We'd like to thank Satchels for letting us host this here every month. And thank you all for sharing your wonderful stories tonight. See you next month.